My father spent his time out the side of the house, digging a hole, 40 feet by 60 feet, 6 feet deep. I think he is digging the pond to feed off the windmill, the one Ma wanted, but he doesn't say. He just digs. He sends me to the train yard to gather boards. Boards that once were boxcars, but now are junk. I bring them back, careful of the scabs and the raw sores on my bare hands. I don't know what he needs boards for. He doesn't tell me. When he's not in the hole digging, he works on the windmill, replacing the parts that kept it from turning. People stop by and watch. They think my father is crazy digging such a big hole. I think he's crazy, too. The water will seep back into the earth. It'll never stay put in any old pond. But my father has thought through all that, and he's digging anyway. I think to talk to Ma about it. And then I remember. I can almost forgive him the taking of Ma's money. I can almost forgive him his night in Guymon getting drunk. But as long as I live, no matter how big a hole he digs, I can't forgive him that pail of kerosene left by the side of the stove. September, 1934. Kilauea. A volcano erupted in Hawaii. Kilauea. It threw huge chunks into the air. The ground shook and smoke choked everything in its path. Sounds a little like a dust storm. September, 1934. Boxes. In my closet are two boxes, the gatherings of my life. Papers, school drawings, a broken hairpin, a dress from my baby days, my first lock of hair, a tiny basket woven from prairie grass, a doll with a china head, a pink ball, 3 dozen marbles, a fan from Baxter's funeral home, my baby teeth in a glass jar, a torn map of the world, 2 candy wrappers, 1,000 things I haven't looked at in years. I kept promising to go through the boxes with Ma and get rid of what I didn't need, but I never got to it, and now my hands hurt, and I haven't got the heart. September, 1934. Night Bloomer. Mrs. Brown's cereus plant bloomed on Saturday night. She sent word after promising I could come see it. I rubbed my gritty eyes with swollen hands. My stomach grizzled as I made my way through the dark to her house. Ma wouldn't have let me go at all. My father just stood in the doorway and watched me leave. It was almost 3 in the morning when I got there. A small crowd stood around. Mrs. Brown said, "The blossom opened at midnight, big as a dinner plate. It took only moments to unfold." How can such a flower find a way to bloom in this drought, in this wind? It blossomed at night when the sun couldn't scorch it, when the wind was quiet, when there might have been a sip of dew to freshen it. I couldn't watch at dawn when the flower touched by the first finger of morning light wilted and died. I couldn't watch as the tender petals burned up in the sun. September, 1934. The Path of Our Sorrow. Miss Freeland said, "During the Great War, we fed the world. We couldn't grow enough wheat to fill all the bellies. The price the world paid for our wheat was so high it swelled our wallets and our heads. And we bought bigger tractors, more acres, until we had mortgages and rent and bills beyond reason. But we all felt so useful we didn't notice. Then the war ended, and before long Europe didn't need our wheat anymore. They could grow their own. But we needed Europe's money to pay our mortgage, our rent, our bills. We squeezed more cattle, more sheep, onto less land, and they grazed down the stubble till they reached root. And the price of wheat kept dropping, so we had to grow more bushels to make the same amount of money we made before. To pay for all that equipment, all that land, and the more sod we plowed up, the drier things got, because the water that used to collect there under the grass, biding its time, keeping things alive through the dry spells, wasn't there anymore. Without the sod, the water vanished. The soil turned to dust, until the wind took it, lifting it up and carrying it away. Such a sorrow doesn't come suddenly. There are 1,000 steps to take before you get there. But now, sorrow climbs up our front steps, big as Texas, and we didn't even see it coming, even though it had been making its way straight for us all along. September, 1934. Autumn, 1934. Hired work. My father hired on at Wireless Power on Tuesday, excavating for towers. He said, "I'm good at digging, and everyone who knows about our hole knows he's telling the truth. He might as well earn a couple dollars. It doesn't look good for the winter crop. Earning some cash will make him feel better. I don't think he'll drink it up. He hasn't done that since Ma. It's hard to believe I once brought money in, too, even if it was just a dime now and then for playing piano. Now I can't hardly stay in the same room with one. Especially Ma's." October, 1934. Almost rain. It almost rained Saturday. The clouds hung low over the farm. The air felt thick. It smelled like rain. In town, the sidewalks got damp. That was all. November, 1934. Those hands. The Wildcats started practice this week. Coach Albright used to say I could play for the team. "You've got what it takes, Billy Joe. Look at the size of those hands," he'd say. "Look at how tall." I'd tell him, "Just because I'm tall doesn't mean I can play basketball, or even that I want to." But he'd say I should play anyway. Coach Albright didn't say anything to me about basketball this year. I haven't gotten any shorter. It's because of my hands. My father used to say, "Why not put those hands to good use?" He doesn't say anything about those hands anymore. Only Arlie Wonderdale talks about them, and how they could play piano again if I would only try. November, 1934. Real snow. The dust stopped, and it snowed. Real snow. Dreamy Christmas snow. Gentle. Nothing blowing, such calm, like after a fever. Wet, clinging to the earth, melting into the dirt, snow. Oh, the grass and the weed and the cattle and the rabbits. And my father will be happy. November, 1934. Dance review. Vera Wonderdale is putting on a dance review at the palace, and Arlie asked if I'd play a number with the Black Mesa boys. It's hard, coming on to Christmas, just me and my father, with no Ma and no little brother. I don't really feel like doing anything. Still, I told Arlie I would try, just because it looked like it meant a lot to him. He said he'd be dancing then, so he needed a piano player. And Mad Dog would be singing, and he knew how I'd just love to be connected with anything Mad Dog's doing. The costumes Vera ordered come all the way from the city, she said. Special, the latest cuts. I wish I could go with her to pick them up. During rehearsals, Mad Dog comes off the stage after his numbers and stands by the piano. He doesn't look at me like I'm a poor motherless thing. He doesn't stare at my deformed hands. He looks at me like I am someone he knows. Someone named Billy Joe Kelby. I'm grateful for that. Especially considering how bad I'm playing. December, 1934. Mad Dog's tail. Mad Dog is surrounded by girls. They ask him how he got his name. He says, "It's not because I'm wild or a crazy untamed boy, but because 14 years ago when I was 2, I would bite anything I could catch hold of. My ma, my brother, Doc Rice, even Reverend Bingham. So my father named me Mad Dog, and it stuck." When I go home, I ask my father if he knows Mad Dog's real name. He looks at me like I'm talking in another language. Ma could have told me. December, 1934. Art exhibit. We had an art exhibit last week in the basement of the courthouse to benefit the library. Price of admission was 1 book or 10 cents. I paid 10 cents the first time, but they let me in the second and third times for free. That was awful kind, since I didn't have another dime, and I couldn't bring myself to hand over Ma's book of poetry from the shelf over the piano. It was really something to see the oil paintings, the watercolors, the pastels and charcoals. There were pictures of the panhandle in the old days, with the grass blowing and wolves. There was a painting of a woman getting dressed in a room of curtains, and a drawing of a railroad station with a garden out the front, and a sketch of a little girl holding an enormous cat in her lap. But now the exhibit is gone, the paintings stored away in spare rooms or locked up where no one can see them. I feel such a hunger to see such things, and such an anger because I can't. December, 1934. Winter, 1935. State tests again. Miss Freeland said our grade topped the entire state of Oklahoma on the state tests again, 24 points higher than the state average. Wish I could run home and tell Ma, and see her nod and hear her say, "I knew you could." It would be enough. January, 1935. Christmas dinner without the cranberry sauce. Miss Freeland was my ma at the school Christmas dinner. I thought I'd be the only one without a real ma, but two other motherless girls came. We served turkey, chestnut dressing, sweet potatoes, and brown gravy. Made it all ourselves, and it came out pretty good. Better than the Christmas dinner I made for my father at home, where we sat at the table, silent, just the two of us. Being there without Ma, without the baby, wouldn't have been so bad if I just remembered the cranberry sauce. My father loved Ma's special cranberry sauce, but she never showed me how to make it. January, 1935. Driving the cows. Dust piles up like snow across the prairie, dunes leaning against fences, mountains of dust pushing over barns. Joe de la Flor can't afford to feed his cows, can't afford to sell them. County Agent Dewey comes, takes the cows behind the barn and shoots them. Too hard to watch their lungs clog with dust, like our chickens suffocated. Better to let the government take them than suffer the sight of their bony hides sinking down into the earth. Joe de la Flor rides the range. Come spring, he'll gather Russian thistle, pulling the plant while it's still green and young, before the prickles form, before it breaks free to tumble across the plains. He gathers thistle to feed what's left of his cattle, his bone-thin cattle, cattle he drives away from the dried-up Beaver River to where the Cimarron still runs, pushing the herd across the breaks where they might last another week, maybe two until it rains. January, 1935. First rain. Sunday night, I stretch my legs in my iron bed under the roof. I place a wet cloth over my nose to keep from breathing dust and wipe the grime tracings from around my mouth and shiver, thinking of Ma. I am kept company by the sound of my heart drumming. Restless, I tangle in the dusty sheets, sending the sand flying, cursing the grit against my skin, between my teeth, under my lids, swearing I'll leave this forsaken place. I hear the first drops. Like the tapping of a stranger at the door of a dream, the rain changes everything. It strokes the roof, streaking the dusty tin, ponging. A concert of rain notes, spilling from gutters, gushing through gullies, soaking into the thirsty earth outside. Monday morning dawns, cloaked in mist. I button into my dress, slip on my sweater, and push my way off the porch, sticking my face into the fog, into the moist skin of the fog. The sound of dripping surrounds me as I walk to town. Soaked to my underwear, I can't bear to go through the schoolhouse door. I want only to stand in the rain. Monday afternoon, Joe de la Flor brushes mud from his horse. Mr. Kincannon hires my father to pull his olds out of the muck on Route 64. And later, when the clouds lift, the farmers surveying their fields nod their heads as the frail stalks revive. Everyone, everything grateful for this moment, free of the weight of dust. January, 1935. Hayden P. Nye. Hayden P. Nye died this week. I knew him to wave. He liked the way I played piano. The newspaper said when Hayden first came, he could see only grass. Grass and wild horses and wolves roaming. Then folks moved in and sod got busted, and bushels of wheat turned the plains to gold, and Hayden P. Nye grabbed the Oklahoma panhandle in his fist and held on. By the time the railroad came in on land, Hayden sold them. The buffalo and the wild horses had gone. Some years, Hayden and I saw the sun dry up his crop, saw the grasshoppers chew it down. But then came years of rain, and the wheat thrived and his pockets filled, and his big laugh came easy. They buried Hayden and I on his land, busted more sod to lay down his bones. Will they sow wheat on his grave where the buffalo once grazed? January, 1935. Scrubbing up dust. Walking past the Crystal Hotel, I saw Jim Martin down on his knees. He was scraping up mud that had dried to crust after the rain mixed with dust Sunday last. When I got home, I took a good look at the steps and the porch and the windows. I saw them with Ma's eyes and thought about how she'd been haunting me. I thought about Ma, who would have washed clothes, beaten furniture, aired rugs, scrubbed floors down on her knees, brush in hand, breaking that mud like the farmers break sod, always watching over her shoulder for the next duster to roll in. My stubborn Ma. She'd be doing it all with my brother Franklin to tend to. She never could stand a mess. My father doesn't notice the dried mud. Least he never tells me. Not that he tells me much of anything these days. With Ma gone, if the mud's to be busted, the job falls to me. It isn't the work I hate, the knuckle-breaking work of beating mud out of every blessed thing, but every day my fingers and hands ache so bad, I think I should just let them rest. Let the dust rest, let the world rest. But I can't leave it rest on account of Ma. Haunting. January, 1935. Outlined by dust. My father stares at me while I sit across from him at the table, while I wash dishes in the basin, my back to him, the picked and festered bits of my hands in agony. He stares at me as I empty the wash water at the roots of Ma's apple trees. He spends long days digging for the electric train folks when they can use him, or working here nursing along the wheat what there is of it, or digging the pond. He sings sometimes under his breath, even now, even after so much sorrow. He sings a man's song, deep with what has happened to us. It doesn't swing lightly the way Ma's voice did, the way Miss Freeland's voice does, the way Mad Dog sings. My father's voice starts and stops, like a car short of gas, like an engine choked with dust, but then he clears his throat and the song starts up again. He rubs his eyes the way I do, with his palms out. Ma never did that. And he wipes the milk from his upper lip same as me, with his thumb and forefinger. Ma never did that either. We don't talk much. My father never was a talker. Ma's dying hasn't changed that. I guess he gets the sound out of him with the songs he sings. I can't help thinking how it is for him without Ma. Waking up alone, only his shape left in the bed, outlined by dust. He always smelled a little like her first thing in the morning, when he left her in bed and went out to do the milking. She'd scuff into the kitchen a few minutes later, bleary-eyed, to start breakfast. I don't think she was ever really meant for farm life. I think once she had bigger dreams, but she made herself over to fit my father. Now he smells of dust and coffee, tobacco and cows. None of the musky woman smell left that was Ma. He stares at me. Maybe he is looking for Ma. He won't find her. I look like him, I stand like him. I walk across the kitchen floor with that long-legged walk of his. I can't make myself over the way Ma did. And yet, if I could look in the mirror and see her in my face, if I could somehow know that Ma and baby Franklin lived on in me. But it can't be. I'm my father's daughter. January, 1935. The President's Ball. All across the land, couples dancing, arm in arm, hand in hand, at the birthday ball. My father puts on his best overalls, I wear my Sunday dress, the one with the white collar, and we walk to town to the Legion Hall and join the dance. Our feet fly, and me and my father, on the wooden floor, whirling to Arlie Wonderdale and the Black Mesa Boys. Till 10, when Arlie stands up from the piano to announce we raised $33 for infantile paralysis, a little better than last year. And I remember last year, when Ma was alive and we were crazy excited about the baby coming, and I played at this same party for Franklin D. Roosevelt, and Joy City, and Arlie. Tonight, for a little while, in the bright hall, folks were almost free of dust, almost free of debt, almost free of fields of withered wheat. Most of the night I think I smiled, and twice my father laughed. Imagine. January, 1935. Lunch. No one's going hungry at school today. The government sent canned meat, rice, potatoes. The bakery sent loaves of bread, and Scotty Moore, George Knoll, and Willie Harkins brought in milk. Fresh, creamy milk straight from their farms. Real lunch, and then stomachs full and feeling fine for classes in the afternoon. The little ones drank themselves into white mustaches. They ate and ate until, pushing back from their desks, their stomachs round, they swore they'd never eat again. The older girls, Elizabeth and Lorraine, helped Miss Freeland cook, and Hillary and I, we served and washed, our ears ringing with the sound of satisfied children. February, 1935. Guests. In our classroom this morning, we came in to find a family no one knew. They were shy, a little frightened, embarrassed. A man and his wife, pretty far along with a baby coming. A baby coming. Two little kids and a grandma. They'd moved into our classroom during the night. An iron bed and some pasteboard boxes, that's all they had. They'd cleaned the room first and arranged it, making a private place for themselves. "I'm on the look for a job," the man said. "The dust blew so mean last night, I thought to shelter my family here a while." The two little kids turned their big eyes from Miss Freeland back to their father. "I can't have my wife sleeping in the cold truck, not now. Not with the baby coming so soon." Miss Freeland said they could stay as long as they wanted. February, 1935. Family school. Every day we bring fixings for soup and put a big pot on to simmer. We share it at lunch with our guests, the family of migrants who have moved out from dust and depression and moved into our classroom. We are careful to take only so much to eat, making sure there's enough soup left in the pot for their supper. Some of us bring in toys and clothes for the children. I found a few things of my brother's and brought them to school. Little feed sack nighties, so small, so full of hope. Franklin never wore a one of the nighties Ma made him, except the one we buried him in. The man, Buddy Williams, helps out around the school, fixing windows and doors, and the bad spot on the steps, cleaning up the schoolyard so it never looks so good. The grandma takes care of the children, bringing them out when the dust isn't blowing, letting them chase tumbleweeds across the field behind the school. But when the dust blows, the family sits in their little apartment inside our classroom, studying Miss Freeland's lessons right alongside us. February, 1935. Birth. One morning when I arrive at school, Miss Freeland says to keep the kids out, that the baby is coming and no one can enter the building until the birthing is done. I think about Ma and how that birth went. I keep the kids out and listen behind me, praying for the sound of a baby crying into this world, and not the silence my brother brought with him. And then the cry comes, and I have to go away for a little while and just walk off the feelings. Miss Freeland rings the bell to call us in, but I'm not ready to come back yet. When I do come, I study how fine that baby girl is. How perfect. And that she is wearing a feed sack nightgown that was my brother's. February, 1935. Time to go. They left a couple weeks after the baby came, all of them crammed inside that rusty old truck. I ran half a mile in the dust to catch them. I didn't want to let that baby go. "Wait for me," I cried, choking on the cloud that rose behind them. But they didn't hear me. They were heading west, and no one was looking back. February, 1935. Something sweet from moonshine. Ashby Derwin and his pal Rush had themselves a fine operation on the Cimarron River, where the water still runs a little, though the fish are mostly dead from the dust floating on the surface. Ashby and Rush were cooking up moonshine in their giant metal still on the bank when Sheriff Robertson caught them. He found jugs of finished whiskey and barrels of mash. He found 2 sacks of rye, and he found sugar. 1,000 pounds of sugar. The government men took Ashby and Rush off to Enid for breaking the law, but Sheriff Robertson stayed behind, took apart the still, washed away the whiskey and the mash, and thought about that sugar. All that sugar. 1/2 ton of sugar. Sheriff decided some should find its way into the mouths of us kids. "Bake for them, Miss Freeland," he said. "Bake them cakes and cookies and pies. Cook them custard and cobbler and crisp. Make them candy and taffy and apple pan dowdy." Apple pan dowdy? These kids, Sheriff Robertson said, ought to have something sweet to wash down their dusty milk. And so we did. February, 1935. Dreams. Each day after class lets out, each morning before it begins, I sit at the school piano and make my hands work. In spite of the pain, in spite of the stiffness and scars, I make my hands play piano. I have practiced my best piece over and over till my arms throb, because Thursday night, the Palace Theater is having a contest. Any man, woman, or child who sings, dances, reads, or plays worth a lick can climb onto that stage. Just register by 4 p.m. and give them a taste of what you can do, and you're in, performing for the crowd, warming up the audience for the Hazel Hurd players. I figure if I practice enough, I won't shame myself. And we sure could use the extra cash if I won. $3 first prize, $2 second, $1 third. But I don't know if I could win anything, not anymore. It's the playing I want most, the proving I can still do it, without Arlie making excuses. I have a hunger for more than food. I have a hunger bigger than Joy City. I want tongues to tie and eyes to shine at me like they do at Mad Dog Craddock. Of course, they never will, not with my hands all scarred up, looking like the earth itself, all parched and rough and cracking. But if I played right enough, maybe they would see past my hands. Maybe they could feel at ease with me again, and maybe then I could feel at ease with myself. February, 1935. The competition. I suppose everyone in Joy City and beyond, all the way to Felt and Keys and even Guyman, came to watch the talent show at the Palace Thursday night. Backstage, we were 17 amateur acts, our wild hearts pounding, our lips sticking to our teeth, our urge to empty ourselves top and bottom, made a sorry sight in front of the famous Hazel Hurd players. But they were kind to us, helped us with our makeup and our hair, showed us where to stand, how to bow, and the quickest route to the toilet. The audience hummed on the other side of the closed curtain. Ivy Huxford kept peeking out and giving reports of who was there, and how she never saw so many seats filled in the palace, and that she didn't think they could squeeze a rattlesnake into the back, even if he paid full price, the place was so packed. My father told me he'd come once chores were done. I guess he did. The Grover boys led us off. They worked a charm, Baby on the sax, Jake on the banjo, and Ben on the clarinet. The Baker family followed, playing just like they do at home every night after dinner. They didn't look nervous at all. The tap dancers? They rattled the teeth in their jaws and the eyeballs in their skulls, their feet flying, their arms swinging, their mouths gapping. Then Sonny Lee Hallam tumbled and leaped onto the stage, the sweat flying off her, spotting the palace floor. Marsh Wharton struggled out, his accordion leading the way. George and Agnes Harkins ran their fingers over the strings of their harps, made you want to look up into the heavens for angels. But only scenery and lights and ropes and sandbags hung overhead. And then there was me on piano. I went on somewhere near the backside of middle, getting more and more jittery with each act till my time came. I played Bye Bye Blackbird my own way, messing with the tempo, and the first part sounded like I used just my elbows, but the middle sounded good, and the end, I forgot I was even playing in front of the packed Palace Theater. I dropped right inside the music and didn't feel anything till after, when the clapping started. And that's when I noticed my hands hurting straight up to my shoulders. But the applause made me forget the pain. The audience roared when I finished. They came to their feet, and I got third prize, $1, while Mad Dog Craddock singing won second, and Ben Grover and his crazy clarinet took first. The tap dancers pouted into their mirrors, peeling off their makeup and their smiles. Bertie Jasper claimed it was all my fault she didn't win, that the judges were just being nice to a cripple. But the Harp and Harkins were kind, and the Hazel Herd players wrapped their long arms around me and said I was swell. And in the sweaty, dim chaos backstage, I ignored the pain running up and down my arms. I felt like I was part of something grand. But they had to give my ribbon and my dollar to my father, 'cause I couldn't hold anything in my hands. February, 1935. The Piano Player. Arlie says, "We're doing a show at the school in a week, Billy Joe. Come play with us." If I asked my father, he'd say yes. It's okay with him if I want to play. He didn't even know I was at the piano again till the other night. He's making some kind of effort to get on better with me now since I did him proud at the palace. But I say no. It's too soon after the contest. It still hurts too much. Arlie doesn't understand. "Just practice more," he says. "You'll get it back. You can travel with us again this summer if you'd like." I don't say it hurts like the parched earth with each note. I don't say one chord and my hands scream with pain for days. I don't show him the swelling or my tears. I tell him, "I'll try." At home, I sit at Ma's piano. I don't touch the keys. I don't know why. I play Stormy Weather in my mind, following the phrases in my imagination, saving strength, so that when I sit down at a piano that is not Ma's, when everyone crowds into the school for Arlie's show, no one can say that Billy Joe Kelby plays like a cripple. March, 1935. No good. I did play like a cripple at Arlie's show, not that Arlie would ever say it. But my hands are no good anymore, my playing's no good. Arlie understands, I think. He won't ask again. March, 1935. Snow. Had to check yesterday morning to make sure that was snow on the ground, not dust. But you can't make a dust ball pack together and slam against the side of the barn and echo across the fields. So I know it was snow. March, 1935. Night school. My father thought maybe he ought to go to night school, so if the farm failed, there'd be prospects to fall back on. He's starting to sound like Ma. "The farm won't fail," I tell him, "long as we get some good rain." I'm starting to sound like him. "It's mostly ladies in those classes," he says. "They take bookkeeping and civics and something called business English." I can't imagine him taking any of those things. But maybe he doesn't care so much about the classes. Maybe he's thinking more about the company of ladies. I'll bet none of the ladies mind spending time with my father. He's still good-looking with his strong back and his blondy red hair and his high cheeks rugged with wind. I shouldn't mind either. It's dinner I don't have to come up with because the ladies bring chicken and biscuits for him. I'm glad to get out of cooking. Sometimes with my hands it's hard to keep the fire, wash the pans, hold the knife and spread a little better. But I do mind his spending time with all those biddies. I turn my back on him as he goes and settle myself in the parlor and touch Ma's piano. My fingers leave sighs in the dust. March, 1935. Dust pneumonia. 2 Fridays ago, Pete Guyman drove in with a truck full of produce. He joked with Calb Hardley, Mr. Hardley's son, while they unloaded eggs and cream down at the store. Pete Guyman teased Calb Hardley about the Wildcats losing to Hooker. Calb Hardley teased Pete Guyman about his wheezy truck sucking in dust. Last Friday, Pete Guyman took ill with dust pneumonia. Nobody knew how to keep that produce truck on the road. It sat filled with turkeys and heavy hens waiting for delivery. It sat out in front of Pete's drafty shack and sits there still. The cream curdling, the apples going soft. Because a couple of hours ago, Pete Guyman died. Mr. Hardley was already on the phone to a new produce supplier before evening. He had people in his store and no food to sell them. His boy, Calb, slammed the basketball against the side of the house until Calb's ma yelled for him to quit. And late that night, a truck rattled up to the store with colored springs, dozens of hens, filthy eggs, and a driver with no interest whatsoever in young Calb Hardley or his precious Wildcats. March, 1935. dust storm. I never would have gone to see the show if I'd known a storm like this would come. I didn't know when going in, but coming out a darker night I'd never seen. I bumped into a box beside the palace door and scraped my shins, then tripped on something in my path, I don't know what, and walked into a phone pole, bruised my cheek. The first car that I met was sideways in the road. Bowed down, my eyes near shut, trying to keep the dust out, I saw his headlights just before I reached them. The driver called me over and I felt my way, following his voice. He asked me how I kept the road. I feel it with my feet, I shouted over the roaring wind. I walk along the edge, one foot on the road, one on the shoulder. And desperate to get home, he straightened out his car and straddled tires on the road and off and slowly pulled away. I kept along. I know that there were others on the road. From time to time, I'd hear someone cry out. Their voices rose like ghosts on the howling wind. No one could see. I stopped at neighbors just to catch my breath and made my way from town out to our farm. Everyone said to stay, but I guessed my father would come out to find me if I didn't show and get himself lost in the raging dust and maybe die. And I didn't want that burden on my soul. Brown earth rained down from sky. I could not catch my breath the way the dust pressed on my chest and wouldn't stop. The dirt blew down so thick it scratched my eyes and stung my tender skin. It plugged my nose and filled inside my mouth. No matter how I pressed my lips together, the dust made muddy tracks across my tongue. But I kept on, spitting out mud, covering my mouth, clamping my nose, the dust stinging the raw and open stripes of scarring on my hands. And after some 3 hours, I made it home. Inside, I found my father's note that said he'd gone to find me, and if I should get home, to just stay put. I hollered out the front door and the back. He didn't hear. I didn't think he would. The wind took my voice and busted it into 1,000 pieces, so small the sound blew out over Ma and Franklin's grave, thinner than a sigh. I waited for my father through the night, coughing up dust, cleaning dust out of my ears, rinsing my mouth, blowing mud out of my nose. Joe de la Fleur stopped by around 4 to tell me they found one boy tangled in a barbed wire fence, another smothered in a drift of dust. After Joe left, I thought of the famous Lindberghs and how their baby was killed and never came back to them. I wondered if my father would come back. He blew in around 6 a.m. It hurt the sight of him. Brown with dirt, his eyes as red as raw meat, his feet bruised from walking in worn shoes, stepping where he couldn't see, on things that bit and cut into his flesh. I tried to scare up something we could eat, but couldn't keep the table clear of dust. Everything I set down for our breakfast was covered before we took a bite, and so we chewed the grit and swallowed, and I thought of the cattle dead from mud in their lungs, and I thought of the tractor buried up to the steering wheel, and Pete Guyman. And I couldn't even recognize the man sitting across from me, sagging in his chair, his red hair gray and stiff with dust, his face deep lines of dust, his teeth streaked brown with dust. I turned the plates and glasses upside down, crawled into bed, and slept. March 1935. Broken Promise. It rained a little everywhere but here. March 1935. Motherless. If Ma could put her arm across my shoulder sometime, or stroke back my hair, or sing me to sleep, making the soft sounds, the reassuring noises, that no matter how brittle and sharp life seemed, no matter how brittle and sharp she seemed, she was still my Ma who loved me. Then I think I wouldn't be so eager to go. March 1935. Following in his steps. Hayden Parley Nye's wife, Fonda, died today, 2 months after she lost her man. The cause of death was dust pneumonia, but I think she couldn't go on without Hayden. When Ma died, I didn't want to go on either. I don't know. I don't feel the same now, not exactly. Now that I see that one day comes after another, and you get through them one measure at a time. But I'd like to go. Not like Fonda Nye, I don't want to die. I just want to go. Away. out of the dust. March 1935. Spring 1935. Heartsick. The hard part is, in spite of everything, if I had any boy court me, it'd be Mad Dog Craddock. But Mad Dog can have any girl. Why would he want me? I'm so restless. My father asks what's going on with me. I storm up to my room, leaving him alone standing in the kitchen. If Ma was here, she would come up and listen. And then later, she would curl beside my father and assure him that everything was all right and soothe him into his farmer's sleep. My father and I, we can't soothe each other. I'm too young, he's too old, and we don't know how to talk anymore, if we ever did. April, 1935. Skin. My father has a raised spot on the side of his nose that never was there before and won't go away. And there's another on his cheek and two more on his neck. And I wonder, why the heck is he fooling around? He knows what it is. His father had those spots, too. April, 1935. Regrets. I never go by Arlie's anymore. Still, every week he comes to school to teach, and sometimes I bump into Vera, or Miller Rice, or Mad Dog. They're always kind. They ask after my father. They ask how my hands are feeling. I cross my arms in front of me tight so my scars won't show. These days, Mad Dog looks at me halfway between picking a fight and kindness. He walks with me away some afternoons. Never says a word. He's quiet once the other girls go off. I've had enough of quiet men. I ought to keep clear of Mad Dog. But I don't. April, 1935. Fire on the rails. I hate fire. Hate it. But the entire Oklahoma panhandle is so dry, everything is going up in flames. Everything too ready to ignite. Last week the school caught fire. Damage was light on account of it being caught early. Most kids joked about it next day, but it terrified me. I could hardly go back in the building. And this week, 3 boxcars in the train yard burned to ash. Jim Goen and Harry Kessler spotted the fire, and that was a miracle considering the fierceness of the dust storm at the time. The fire boys tore over, but they couldn't put the blaze out without water, and water is exactly what they didn't have. So they separated the burning cars and moved them down a siding, away from any little thing that might catch if the flames hopped. It was all they talked about at school. The dust blew, they say, so you'd think it would have smothered the fire out. But the flames, crazy in the wind,